This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, political crisis in Venezuela. Last week, tens of thousands of Venezuelans took to the streets of Caracas and other cities to drive President Nicolas Maduro out of office. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. The recent unrest was triggered by Maduro's assumption of a new six-year term in early January on the basis of an election condemned in and outside Venezuela as fraudulent. The National Assembly, which the opposition controls, chose a young and dynamic new leader, Juan Guaido. Because Maduro's re-election was found to be illegitimate, the Assembly deemed the post vacant, and Mr. Guaido declared himself interim president. The Trump administration promptly announced its recognition of Juan Guaido as the new president of Venezuela, even as President Nicolas Maduro refused to step down. Canada and numerous Latin American countries, including Brazil, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, and Peru, followed the U.S. lead. Venezuela was once Latin America's richest country and one of its longest-running democracies. Today, it's nearly a failed state, as runaway inflation has plunged much of the country into desperate poverty. Food and drug shortages are widespread. Public order is collapsing and crime is rising. More than 3 million Venezuelans have fled the country, many as refugees. However, the opposition has formidable obstacles to overcome. To ensure loyalty, over the past two decades, the ruling party has taken complete control of all branches of power and placed pro-government soldiers in top military ranks, even putting military men in charge of the nation's crown jewel, the state oil company, PDVSA. The Trump administration imposed sanctions this week against the oil company, seeking to cripple the government by cutting off its main source of revenue and foreign currency. Venezuelan authorities condemned the sanctions. They have also moved to prohibit self-declared interim president Juan Guaido from leaving the country and to freeze his bank accounts. To better understand the roots and wide-ranging ramifications of the escalating crisis in Venezuela, we welcome two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, which is a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs, and Benjamin Gedan. He's senior advisor to the Latin American program and director of the Argentina Project at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Benjamin joins us here in the studio at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
And Eric Farnsworth joins us by phone from his office. Eric, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back with you, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you first, Eric. I'd like to get your quick reaction to the fast-paced developments in Venezuela. To what extent are we at a true inflection point in the country, and what are the risks and opportunities for true transition?
Well, fast-paced is really the right way to describe it. Events on the ground are changing seemingly by the hour, certainly by the day, and they're somewhat volatile as well. The assumption by Nicolas Maduro of a second term on January 10 really precipitated this crisis because he claims a mandate that he did not earn through the ballot box because he ran his own elections in May of 2018. They were neither free nor fair, but based on the results of that, then he claimed another term. And it's that the democratic legislature of Venezuela, according to Venezuela's constitution, has rejected. And based on that, the United States and others in the international community have come alongside now Juan Guaido and confirmed their recognition of him as the interim president of Venezuela. So with that as the background, you do have now a very changing circumstances because clearly the Maduro regime is not going to simply acquiesce to that. Their direct leadership is being challenged, and they are being increasingly sanctioned by the international community, and so it's quite likely that they will try to take additional steps against what they consider to be the opposition, what the United States considers to be the legitimate government of Venezuela. So this is a fast-moving target, and we'll have to wait to see where it actually goes.
And of course, Benjamin Gedan here in the studio. Maduro has taken the opportunity to condemn the United States and sort of bring back those echoes of U.S. imperialism, when in fact, this was really a grassroots movement. And the protests that led to Juan Guaido's assumption of power were different this time. Talk about that.
I mean, I think the domestic unrest in Venezuela is driven by conditions on the ground, this extraordinary collapse in the Venezuelan economy and the resulting damage to the quality of life of the Venezuelan people. The numbers are well known, but you have scarcities of food and medicine. You've had more than 3 million Venezuelans flee the country because of those conditions, not to mention extraordinary levels of violent crime. All of that are a phenomenon in Venezuela, and the reaction is to those conditions. I think the United States has exerted leadership in the international community to try to raise pressure on Venezuela and to try to promote a democratic transition there. I don't think that has to be denied, but I think the United States in this case, and that's somewhat unusual in U.S. foreign policy these days, has been multilateral in its approach. And so it has worked very hard to use multilateral institutions such as the Organization of American States and to seek to bring with it lots of allies in Latin America, now in Europe and elsewhere in this process, and again, has done so successfully. So I think the effort to portray this as U.S.-driven won't work.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about the U.S.-led effort and how you see it. Do you agree with the U.S. actions, particularly the overall reaction and immediate recognition of Juan Guaido and the recent ones with respect to sanctions on PDVSA? Is that the right way to go?
You know, Ben Gadan makes very important points here that the circumstances on the ground are so awful that, in fact, up to, and some people say even more than 10% of Venezuela's total population is now outside the country, many as refugees. And so the United States and others have recognized that reality and are taking steps to see if there are ways to mitigate that. But the reality is, as well, they are supporting the actions that have been taken according to Venezuela's constitution. So this is something that I think a lot of observers miss. They put it into the context of history and U.S. actions during the Cold War and some of this sort of framework that is just very natural to many people without looking at the actual circumstances in Venezuela and seeing in this some sort of a nefarious plot by the United States rather than an effort by the international community to really restore democracy and help the Venezuelan people. And so within that context, are the steps that the U.S. has taken going to help lead to that desired result? And I think that's something we can't know until it actually happens. Now, the latest step, as you alluded to, Carol, is the imposition of sanctions in the energy sector. That's something that on a bipartisan basis had been withheld for some time on the thinking that, in fact, doing so, sure, it would hurt the regime, but it would also in some ways hurt the Venezuelan people. And nobody wants to hurt the Venezuelan people. In fact, they're the victims here, not the aggressors. But having said that, it appears that the administration views the situation as so dire on the ground that they're looking for any step that they can take from an economic perspective to really try to pressure the Maduro regime to change its behavior and ultimately to accede to free and fair elections that will bring a new government to power in Venezuela.
Benjamin Gadan, do you think the sanctions on PDVSA could lead to a change of behavior by the Maduro regime?
I think it's quite risky. This is not a novel idea. This has been deliberated upon by the United States under two administrations and in Congress as well. And I think there's a reason why the United States has delayed taking that step. And precisely, it's because you're guaranteed to negatively affect humanitarian conditions that are already dire. You are not guaranteed to have the result you seek in terms of dislodging Nicolas Maduro. He will likely find other buyers for this oil. He will lose money in the process from transportation and lower prices. But at the end of the day, he very well may be able to hold on. And what you will have achieved is to, again, create greater human suffering. Your other risk is you may fracture the congressional consensus on this issue. That's been extraordinary and important.
There are the risks, but I believe that the sanctions will be coupled by $20 million in humanitarian aid that may mitigate somewhat. What do you think, Benjamin?
No, it won't mitigate it in the least. And that's because the government of Venezuela refuses to even acknowledge the humanitarian crisis and makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to help Venezuelans on the ground. The United States, I think, has not been generous enough in helping Venezuelans who have already left. It's about $100 million the United States has been spending, largely in Colombia, which has absorbed about half of the Venezuelan flows of migration. I think the United States could be much more generous. The United States could be offering temporary protected status to Venezuelans in the United States and could be leading a donor effort to try to support Venezuelans who have already left. As for the result of oil sanctions, those results will occur within Venezuela, and those Venezuelans, unfortunately, are not given access to U.S. assistance.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Benjamin Gadan, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Advisor to the Latin American Program and Director of the Argentina Project at the Wilson Center. We're discussing the political crisis in Venezuela as pressure grows on President Nicolas Maduro to step aside. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout-out to Hideyuki Kanematsu from Japan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about the crisis in Venezuela. Back to you, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about the powers that are supporting Maduro. For example, we have Russia, which has condemned the United States and others for recognizing Juan Guaido. How do you see the role of Russia complicating the situation?
Well, it certainly is a complication, and there are many other actors involved as well, Cuba, China, Turkey, of all countries, for reasons we can talk about. But there are any number of authoritarian regimes around the world who have been supportive of the Maduro regime. I think not necessarily, it must be said, because they have any great affinity for Maduro himself or even his national project. What they want is the same thing many people want who purchase them on the open market. It's the natural resources of Venezuela, and these countries are, frankly, looting Venezuela with the Maduro administration's help. And so that complicates it because there's a lot of money that's been involved, loans, purchases of properties, certainly corrupt activities, arms sales, and all of these things are challenging the ability of Democrats in Venezuela to actually try to address the situation nonviolently and according into the ballot box. But you do have to wonder, when push comes to shove, whether they will really go to the mat for Maduro, somebody who has wrecked his own country, or if this has really just been a target of opportunity that at the end of the day they'll be looking to shift allegiances because, again, their interest is not the government on top of the ground, it's the resources below the ground.
That's a very good point. So that question to you, Ben Gadan, when push comes to shove, will the likes of Russia, China, Cuba, even Turkey, you know, will they go to the mat for Maduro or will they cave?
Yeah, I would distinguish among this sort of rogues gallery of authoritarian allies of the Maduro regime. And importantly, the categories are those that have the wherewithal to help and those that don't. The Cubans clearly don't have the resources. Neither, frankly, do the Russians or the Turks. It's only China that actually could bail out Venezuela. And it has shown over the last 2 years of utter collapse in Venezuela that it's unwilling to. The only motivation they would have, frankly, to stop the collapse of the government is if they were assured that they would have no place in a future Venezuela. And I don't think that's the case. I think the opposition may not honor all of the loans, particularly with the levels of corruption that we have seen and the misspending of this foreign aid. But I think what you will see is a welcoming of Chinese investment as Venezuela tries to get itself back on its feet.
Turning back to you, Eric Farnsworth, analysts are saying that real change is going to have to come from within. So that leads us to talk about the military. To what extent do you think that the military would be willing to, in a sense, turn on Maduro? They're certainly backing him. What are the prospects of that?
20 years of Chavismo in Venezuela, first Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro have made it a priority to keep the security forces loyal to the regime, not just the professional military and armed forces, but also paramilitaries, police forces, and frankly, goon squads that run around on motorcycles enforcing the will of the Maduro regime. And they have done so by access to unbelievable amounts of corruption, whether it's through manipulated exchange rates or access to oil proceeds or, frankly, drug trafficking or illegal gold mining. You can basically go down the list and any number of illegal activities that have been not just allowed by the regime but, frankly, supported because this is the way that the military is able to stay loyal to the government. But that in some ways only goes to the upper levels and perhaps some of the mid-levels. And, you know, the lower levels of the security forces are just like anybody else in Venezuela. They're suffering, and their families are suffering. And there's an active effort underway right now. We see television clips of opposition leaders going to police on the streets and military folks standing guard over demonstrations and handing them papers, asking them not to fire on Venezuelan citizens and to change their allegiance to the Guaido government and to, frankly, lay down their arms. Now, that hasn't necessarily had a very broad impact to this point, but there are active efforts underway along those lines. And the reason being, just as you're implying, Carol, at the end of the day, the military and the security forces are the arbiters in terms of who's going to be in control in Venezuela. And to the extent that they remain loyal to Maduro, it's going to be very difficult to dislodge him. And if they shift their allegiance, then I think that suggests a quite different outcome.
So the question to you then, Ben-Gadhen, do you see signs of the military eventually switching sides, you know, changing its allegiance from Maduro to Guaido, given Guaido's offers of amnesty and the people trying to persuade the security forces? How do you see that?
I think by all accounts, the Cuban intelligence assistance that the Venezuelan government receives has been quite effective in rooting out potential coup plots among lower-level officers. So I think the motivation is there by all means, and particularly among enlisted folks. But I think it's been difficult to organize under the scrutiny of the intelligence services, particularly with help from the Cubans. That leaves us really focused on the elites. And I think for the elites, this regime has been the meal ticket and the get-out-of-jail-free card. And I don't think they'll break with the regime until the absolute last moment when they think it's about to fall, at which point offers of amnesty will be quite attractive.
Well, speaking of those offers of amnesty, let's go back to Juan Guaido. Eric Farnsworth, talk about him, who he is and his background. Talk about him as an interim leader, at least.
Well, he is the head of the national legislature, the one institution in Venezuela that is democratically elected and maintains a democratic legitimacy. And because of a rotating leadership scenario among the opposition parties, he found himself as the head of the national legislature when January 10 came around, and that's the date by which the previous mandate of Nicolas Maduro expired. And according to the Venezuelan constitution, then, the head of the national legislature then becomes the interim president of the country until elections can be contested later on. And by virtue of the fact that he was in that position, he is now the interim president. He is relatively young, that's correct. He's in his mid-30s, and somebody who has not, to this point, had a large profile in Venezuela or internationally. And so he is learning by doing, but it's amazing how effective his initial steps have been in terms of trying to organize a government. You know, he is named ambassadors, which have been accepted in the United States and Argentina and throughout Latin America and elsewhere. He is now making moves to appoint a new board for PDVSA and CITGO, and he's looking to take additional steps to really form a government. And each step he takes, it puts the Maduro regime back on their heels and unable to really set the agenda. They have to react to the agenda. And I think this is the first time that they've been put in that position in the 20 years of Chavismo. So he really has changed the circumstances on the ground. And in some ways, the reason why he has so much popular support is because support has been quickly waning away from Maduro, but also because as a younger person, he does not have the same record that many of the other Venezuelan opposition leaders have had with years in politics and maybe some political baggage. But Guaido just simply doesn't have that same profile. And so he's a fresh face. He's energetic, he's personable and photogenic, and so a lot of people have rallied to his cause.
Benjamin Geda, anything to add or subtract to who is Juan Guaido?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general the Venezuelan opposition gets a bit of a bad rap. I mean, they're operating under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. It is an authoritarian state that has been willing to imprison and exile leaders of the opposition, has been willing to disband opposition parties, and ultimately has been willing to steal elections. In that context, I think historically the Venezuelan opposition has been able to mobilize the Venezuelan people, has been able to coalesce in election time. That's how they ended up in control of the National Assembly, and also have been able to produce primaries and produce viable candidacies. I think in that situation, yes, he comes in and is a charismatic new face, race, but I think he is building upon what has been a very courageous opposition that is unfairly judged by its divisions, which you'd find in any coalition government, and particularly in one trying to operate in these trying circumstances.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth.
I think it's a very important point, and to the extent that the opposition may have been considered to be divided before, it's now clearly unified. And, you know, Guaido, the other thing about his profile is he's not from an oligarchic background. He's from a more of a poor background, and he has a different profile, and so he just does not raise the same types of antibodies as previous opposition leaders may have.
And, Eric, what about the region? What about the OAS? Do they have a unified stance? And how important is it to get more regional players on board?
The Secretary General of the OAS has been very aggressive on Venezuela for years. He's taken a real leadership position trying to highlight the abuses of the Maduro regime and rally the international community. And from my perspective, he's done an amazing job. But the OAS itself is a collection of member countries. And if the member countries can't form consensus around certain issues, then it really hamstrings the institution from being able to take meaningful steps. And that has been the reality for some time. Clearly, the support for change in Venezuela has been increasing at the OAS. More countries are voting to support steps that would lead to democratic change. But the institution is still divided, and in part that's because the Venezuelans have frankly done a very good job using the resources of the state, the national patrimony, to buy off countries in the region to make sure that they continue to offer support at the OAS. So this is a complicated issue, but it must be said that the countries, perhaps too slowly to some, but the countries are moving toward the direction of really seeking some meaningful progress in Venezuela.
Benjamin Gadin, to what extent is this an impediment, that is, the fact that the OAS member states aren't really unified? We know Mexico is neutral. Does this pose an impediment to an alliance that seeks to drive Maduro from office?
I think it is an obstacle to regional collaboration. Regional coordination is needed principally on the migration challenge, but more so in terms of pressuring Nicolas Maduro and combating the impression that he would like to give that this is a U.S.-led process. I think it's also a lost opportunity. Latin America is one of the few regions in the world that has formally adopted democracy as the only option for a political model. The Organization of American States has something pretty remarkable called the Inter-American Democratic Charter, and under that charter, Venezuela should have been suspended years ago for having dismantled its democracy. And the Organization of American States has not been able to achieve the consensus necessary to take that and other steps to address the crisis. The Secretary General has been heroic, I think, in moving well beyond the members of the organization. But unfortunately, it has some structural problems, and one of them we've alluded to, which is the awesome power of the Caribbean votes, one vote per country. And those are votes that are completely captured by Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. And Eric Farnsworth, as we close, where do you think this is all going? Do you think the impasse can truly be broken, and can we avoid violence and bloodshed? How optimistic are you that a breakthrough can occur to help the Venezuelan people who desperately need change?
My very strong hope is that this does resolve itself quickly and without violence on behalf of the Venezuelan people, but history does teach that that's probably unlikely because, again, the Maduro government doesn't seem to want to go anywhere anytime soon, and now that many countries have recognized an alternative in Venezuela, you do have a stalemate, so something's going to have to give. You know, it's just an untenable situation to have two people who claim the presidency of a country and for that to go on for any, you know, significant period of time. So I hope that I'm wrong. I think that it may get worse before it gets better. But the one thing that I would certainly hope is that this is an issue that the Venezuelans themselves seek to resolve, and in the end that they do and quickly do it.
And Benjamin Gadin, you get the last word.
I think there's a creative attempt right now by the international community to conjure out of nothing an alternative president of Venezuela. I think it's the right approach, and it's the only fair and moral approach, but it's not easy. At this point, the strong man, Nicolas Maduro, who runs Venezuela, runs it completely. He's control of the security services. He controls all territory, and he has some strong international allies. I think unless there's a massive and prolonged mobilization, which is possible, or the military elites break with the regime, also possible, I think you are in for a stalemate.
All right. Well, on that rather dubious note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll certainly be following the events in Venezuela and bring them to you in the days ahead. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the America Society and Council of the Americas, and Benjamin Gadan, he's Senior Advisor to the Latin American Program and Director of the Argentina Project at the Wilson Center. Gentlemen, thank you. Gracias for your keen insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.